The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thanks, Peter. I didn't understand a word you said, but... <There's>... When you learn to speak English, get back to me. or Scottish English, as it should be spoken. What better way to start a Thursday morning than with a bunch of lawyers in a restaurant called Silks? If you're not a lawyer, you're especially welcome. You can defend me. My problem is that when I relax in a place, I end up thinking out loud and saying things I shouldn't say, so please do not be offended. I was in a place last Friday night and they asked me a question, and I gave the one word answer, lipstick, and they're still not speaking to me. I'll tell you the question another time, but please do feel free to ask questions. This is a second part of a three-part series, and I was talking about the importance of evidence, and one of the evidences I want to talk about is the Bible. Now, there's an instinctive reaction with that. There are some people who are Christians who go automatically, well, the Bible, it's great and it's wonderful and of course we believe it, and then they don't think about it. And then there are other people who go, oh, the Bible, that oppressive book. So, for example, Christopher Hitchens, the Bible was put together by crude, uncultured human mammals. The one I regularly hear from atheist evangelists, and they do exist, is... the Bible was written by a bunch of illiterate desert shepherds, to which my legal brain immediately goes, if they were illiterate, how did they write it? And if you've read John chapter 1, it's one of the most extraordinary pieces of writing in any language anywhere in the world. How can you say it was written by people who were illiterate? But that does tend to be the notion. I like what Pope Benedict says. Jesus' teaching is not the product of human learning of whatever kind. It originates from immediate contact with the Father, from face-to-face dialogue, from the vision of the One who rests close to the Father's heart. It is the Son's Word. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do, I'm not going to ask you to accept this, but I'm going to ask you to think about it. Is it not logically possible that if God exists, He could communicate by revealing through the medium of words to the creatures He has made who use words to communicate? That, to me, makes a lot of obvious sense. I'm just saying, allow the possibility, and then you can start thinking about whether it actually happened. The minute you discount the possibility, you show yourself to be so close-minded that there's nothing that can be said. It's a bit like sometimes arguing with a flat earth conspiracy theorist. I'd actually met genuine flat earthers, and I thought they were winding me up, but they were serious. And I said, I'm going to Australia, and they said, no, it's not really Australia. And they really believed it, and I thought, what do I do in this post-truth alternative fact society? So you've got to allow the possibility. As regards thinking, what I want to say about thinking is this. My interest is history, and I came across a book. I specialize particularly in Weimar Germany. And I came across a book by Traudl Junge, who was Hitler's secretary. And the extraordinary thing is, right until about 1947, she said she had no idea what was happening. Now, she was his personal secretary. How could she have no idea? She was in on meetings that many of the Nazi hierarchy weren't in on. And she basically said, I shut my mind to it. She writes this, a life of conscious thought began for me only after the war, when I started thinking about important things, asking questions, wondering about the meaning of human relationships. Until then, I just accepted everything as it happened to me. I moved from place to place without consciously wanting to leave my mark on them. Wherever I was, I just tried to take an interest in what I was doing and gave of my best. Now, I really do not wish to be offensive to any of you, but I do want to ask if you consciously think rather than just exist. And what I mean by that is, you know, the big things that are on your mind. I know people who are absolutely absorbed by what you call soccer, what we call football. I know other people who are utterly absorbed by politics. They don't have much of a life. And I know other people that all they can think about is what they're doing next in terms of their work. But I'm not suggesting that every single day you spend your whole life meditating on the meaning of life, but just occasionally it would do you some good to stop and think. And this issue is enormously important. So I'm going to argue that we can actually know what the teaching of Jesus is, and that it is relatively, in fact, extremely important. The University of Dundee doesn't have any theology. It doesn't have a theology department. So I noticed one day that they had were advertising do-it-yourself Buddhism classes, and do-it-yourself Buddhism 1, do-it-yourself Buddhism 2, do-it-yourself Buddhism 3. And again, the way my mind works, I thought, if it's do-it-yourself, why do you need a teacher? But never mind. I went to them and said, why don't you have a Christianity class? And they said, oh, we don't think anyone would be interested, and there's churches anyway. So I said, let me try one. And so I did. I wrote an advert saying, are you interested in history, philosophy, music, poetry, art, just anything? I wrote just this massive list. Then you need to understand Christian theology. And I didn't think anyone would come. And the class completely sold out. They couldn't believe it. And most of the people who came, I think there were only two who were Christians. And I think that if you profess to be educated, and I'm assuming that all lawyers are educated, you will need to know some of the teaching of Jesus, even if you only want to argue against it. So, what is the teaching of Jesus and why should we like it? What you often get from people is, Jesus is cool, it's the church I don't like. And what people do is they invent their own personal Jesus. Actually, Christopher Hitchens got it right. Jesus said some things that were really, really, really unpleasant and really upset people. But I do think that his message is incredibly important. How do we know what his teachings are? Well, I know that we're limited in time, so that's maybe something you can ask questions about. But let me simply state this, that I'm a historian, and I look at the evidence, the textual evidence for the manuscripts of the Bible. That's without saying that the Bible is true, but just the textual evidence. So, for example, within the first 200 years of the Bible being written, we have about 30,000 extant manuscripts in Greek, Aramaic, and so on, scattered from all over the known world at the time, particularly the Mediterranean world, from Alexandria in Egypt through to Spain. And it's the most incredibly well-documented book. Let me give you just one illustration. Homer's Odyssey, which no one doubts we have the original script of, the earliest copies we have are 1,000 years after it was written, and we only have 3 of those. So the evidence in terms of the existence of the Bible and coming from around that time is incredibly high. There's a professor at the University of St. Andrews, Richard Bauckham, who's written a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, in which he argues that the Gospels are essentially eyewitness accounts. And again, for those of you who are involved in law, you realize the importance of having actual eyewitnesses. What is interesting is that all 4 Gospels differ. Now again, forgive me, this is a bit like, I have a congregation full of medics, and whenever I use a medical illustration, they burst out laughing. So let me take my life in my hands and use a legal illustration. I don't know if you have this here in Australia, but in Scotland, in the legal system, there's something called the Murov Doctrine. And it goes like this. If I am accused by somebody of sexually assaulting them, and it's one person, it's their word against mine, then in our legal system, unless there is actual physical evidence, you know, like a camera or DNA or something, then you can't take one person's word against another. You need witnesses. But if you get 4 people who come and they make the same accusation against me, even though saying I did it at different times, then because there are 4 different things, then I'm much more likely to be found guilty, because how likely is it that they would be 4 different similar accusations? However, and this did happen in a case that I was involved in, not me personally, I wasn't the one accused, but I was involved as a witness. If four different people come with exactly the same testimony, almost word for word, then it is indisputable that they must have collaborated. And so the Muroff doctrine says when there is proof of collaboration, you cannot find somebody guilty. And here's the fascinating thing about the Gospels. The fact that the Gospels are different is evidence of their being, is far more likely to be evidence of them being true than if they were word for word the same. If they were word for word the same, you just say, they just copied each other. But they're not word for word the same. Eyewitnesses' accounts invariably are different. But when you put them together, they enable you to get a whole picture. I think that's why we've got the four Gospels. Let me just say some misunderstandings about the Bible. Let me say things about what Jesus taught. First of all, I do want to say that all the Bible speaks of Christ. So in Luke 24, "How foolish you are," said Jesus, "how slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." That's a real key to understanding the Bible, by the way. It is seeing it all as focused and centered on Christ. Now, there are difficulties, many difficulties in the Bible, and you may want to raise some of those. The other thing about the teaching of Jesus, I think it's a good motto, by the way, for those of you who are lawyers who have to speak in court. Jesus said great things so simply that he seems not to have thought about them, and yet so clearly that it is obvious what he thought about them. Such clarity, together with such simplicity, is wonderful. So there's a good motto for you as lawyers. Clarity and simplicity, as well as being thoughtful. How do we understand the teaching of Jesus today? I do think there's incredible depth in it, and I think that Christians have reduced it to a simplistic formula, have not done it any favours whatsoever. I sometimes think when I go to a church or watch a Christian TV programme, and hear teaching that's shallow, superficial, that it's as much use as a chocolate teapot. And it's very, very frustrating for me. But I also find it incredibly frustrating that people who are quite clever then seek to say, well, the Bible's message is wrong or Jesus got it wrong and let me give you an updated and correct version. I think it's... I find personally in the Bible just an incredible depth that I have been studying for over 40 years, and it's still very much the challenges me. What is this message that he gives? Now, again, forgive me saying this, but I think that most Christian churches have now resorted, maybe not in Sydney, but have now resorted to what we call moralistic therapeutic deism. In other words, it's be good, feel good about yourself, and there is some kind of force somewhere. May the force be with you. And my point is just simply this. I wouldn't touch a church like that with a barge pole. I can get better music at a U2 concert. I can get better fellowship down the pub. And I can get, I can feel better by, I don't know, going to a restaurant, I suppose, and getting a really, really nice meal. So for me, church is pointless unless it communicates the message of Jesus Christ. I'm not going to go into this, but an awful lot of Christian churches try and distort that message. And then you get an awful lot of people say, I'm the only one who's got the real message. And they're usually quite nuts, if I'm allowed to use that technical expression. Jesus himself said what the good news was. I must preach the good news of the kingdom of God to the other towns also, because that is why I was sent. And then you look at what he taught, and I would say that the whole of the Bible revolves around that. I'm fascinated that a man like Bertrand Russell, who was obviously a very strong atheist, he said this: "Nothing can penetrate the loneliness of the human heart except the highest intensity of the sort of love that religious teachers have provided." And I think the message that Jesus gives is a message about himself and who he is. And that probably is the biggest question you will ever have to face in your life. You may not think so, but what do you think of Jesus? And we'll come on to that next week. Just a couple of things to finish before we have some questions. Does Jesus still speak today? I have occasionally, because of my work, I occasionally get people coming up to me, and I don't know if people have ever done this to you, and they say, Jesus told me. So imagine you've got a client in court, and they've been charged with, let's say, theft. Why did you take that iPhone from the shop? Well, the Holy Spirit came to me and Jesus told me I should take it. That's not really a very good defense. And I suspect you may end up in a psychiatric institution. My wife works as a mental health social worker, and I have met Moses and the devil and Mary and Jesus, all of them in psychiatric institutions. So, in fact, my favorite story about that is a church near us. This man stood up and he said, I am Jesus and I have to tell you this. And this woman who was dead smart, she stood up and she said, I'm Mary and I'm your mother and I'm telling you to sit down and shut up. Which I just thought was great. But, do you know, if I said to you, well, like, God has spoken to me, I'm very wary of that as a Christian. I think, how do you know you've not just had a bad cheese night? You know, I had a dream. The dreams I had last night, I don't want to tell you. One was I dreamt I was coming here and I was really late. The other was that the breakfast was horrible. So I'm sure none of those dreams have turned out to be true. But how do we know? How does Jesus speak? Well, let me cite to you a French lawyer, Jean Calvin, who says this. Let us not take into our heads either to seek out God anywhere else than in his sacred word, or to think anything about him that is not prompted by his word, or to speak anything that is not taken from that word. And Calvin's nemesis, the Pope, not the current one, but Pope Benedict, says this, if people do not believe the word of Scripture, then they will not believe someone coming from the next world either. The highest truths cannot be forced into the type of empirical evidence that only applies to material reality. Here's an extraordinary claim. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. I once stood on top of the Empire State Building and looked out over the Twin Towers. And this is the truth. I thought, those are incredible buildings, but one day they will disappear. You know, people, all these people rushing to work, making their millions, this is all going to disappear. And I remember that when, of course, 9/11 happened. Jesus is making an extraordinary claim. He's saying, you're going to forget loads and loads of things. They're all going to disappear. But my words will never disappear. That's why I think it's wise for us to pray with the psalmist, open my eyes that I may see wonderful things in your law. I realize I'm making an extraordinary claim that God has spoken, that God has revealed himself, and that you can examine that and you can test that. As I said last week, I don't expect anyone to believe without evidence, but I do expect that any intelligent person will examine the evidence. So I hope that you will do that. And if you profess to be an educated, cultured person, you will at least read the Bible. And if you profess to be open-minded, I would suggest you read it with an open mind. And if you are a Christian and you never think about the Bible, I would suggest you start thinking, because it's very dishonoring to the God who gave you his word for you just to say, ah, no, I just accept it. That's not the way to be. You've got to use your brain, and your mind has to be renewed so that your heart can be renewed. So I will leave it there and we'll go on to questions, I think. Okay, I'm going to try and answer these. And please, if you ask them and you feel they've been answered inadequately, which they will be, please feel free to cross-examine me. Can a Christian accept Jesus' teaching but be uncomfortable with parts of the Old Testament? I would say if you are a Christian and you read the Old Testament and you're not uncomfortable with parts of it, then you're either brain dead or you're just not understanding what you're reading, because it's incredibly uncomfortable. Actually, if you're a Christian, you read the New Testament, it's incredibly uncomfortable. Please don't think that the New Testament is all kind of cute and cuddly and the Old Testament is... because the Old Testament barely mentions hell. Jesus does 9 times. That's really freakish for me. It's really hard. That's the only reason I believe in hell is because Jesus talked about it. There are parts of the Old Testament you're thinking, how on earth? I mean, just let me illustrate this for you. When I became a Christian, I was a very reluctant teenager. I was 17 years old. I had a glorious life ahead of me, and then I became a Christian. And but I was quite happy with the Bible and everything. And then someone gave me a book, which was 100 problems in the Bible answered. Now, I had no problems with the Bible until I read that book. And after I read the book, I had 100 problems. Because the problems were real and the answers were rubbish. And I really panicked. I thought, where am I? I'm going to, you know, have I been brainwashed? Is this, you know, how can this be right? And I looked at some of Old and New Testament passages and thought, no way, no way, no way. And then I stopped and I thought, you're a wee child. You're a baby in the Christian faith. Take your time and trust, you know. And I would say of those 100 problems, I'm now down to about 4. I think I've got the other 96. It's just taken a long, long time for me to work things out and understand things. I would say there was something wrong if you're not uncomfortable with some of the stuff you read in the Bible, both old and new. Has the Old Testament moral law applied? How does it go with the New Testament, I think? Here's the important thing to understand, and you understand this with reading documents. In the Bible, a huge amount is descriptive, not prescriptive. So it's describing what happened. So let's take a story, for example, of Jephthah sacrificing his daughter. That is describing what happens. It's not God saying, this is what happened and it was really good and this is what you should do. And a huge amount of it is that. The other thing, as a basic principle of interpreting historical documents or any documents, is unless you get the context right, then you can make it mean whatever you want. So, do you know, for example, that the Bible does say there is no God? Psalm 14, verse 1, there is no God. The context before it says the fool says in his heart there is no God. But technically, the Bible does say there is no God. So you've always got to get the context. And in that sense, a very simple understanding is that in the Old Testament Mosaic law, which was given to the theocratic state of Israel, you have the civil law, the ceremonial law, and the moral law. The ceremonial is all to do with the priests and the sacrifices. That's all done away with when the temple's done away with. The civil law was for a theocracy that existed at that time. The New Testament does away with theocracy. You can take principles from it. So, for example, when you have a flat roof, make sure you build a parapet around it. That's early health and safety. Well, you can go to town with that if you want to be a health and safety lawyer. I mean, you can really say the Bible says you should have this, this, then this, because you're applying the principle. And the moral law is understood to be God's unchanging law of what is right and wrong in terms of morality. That doesn't include the civil punishments, and it doesn't include what we might call reflections of that, which we are to work out within our own cultures because God has made us free beings. So I think the Old Testament moral law is exactly the same as the New Testament moral law, and it's why Jesus says not one whit of it will disappear. All right. Those are great questions. Sorry for taking so long to answer that. The Bible is a very big book, maybe 1,000 pages. If someone is unfamiliar with it, where should they start reading? Harry Potter's quite a big book too. And wait till you try War and Peace. Some people say start at the beginning. The Bible's 66 books. So here's my personal recommendation. To most young people, I say start with the book of Ecclesiastes. Because that's weird. And it gets people questioning. And it's, for me, it's wonderful. Generally, I think it's a mistake to begin at Genesis 1:1 and then work your way through. Although I have met people who've done that. I would read Genesis. I would read the Gospels. I would read the book of Romans. The Psalms, which are poetry, incredibly emotional. The book of Isaiah, which also has some of the most extraordinary poetry ever in the world. Proverbs, which are, I know some business people, and what they've done is they produced a calendar, a flip-over calendar, that has a different proverb for every day of the month. And they're just incredible. So I would say, mix and match. Don't just read the New Testament, but don't just start at the beginning. And when you come on to Revelation, have fun. How is the Bible still relevant when the world has changed so much in 21 centuries? For the same reason the law of gravity is. For the same reason that principles of justice are. For the same reason that do not steal, do not murder. Has the world changed all that much? Science has progressed, but has humanity progressed? Remember, the Bible's not a science textbook. And it's not a manual for life. It's not even a moral code book. It's a book of revelation. And when Jesus said, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never, we find them even more relevant. I mean, let me give you just one example how this works. So I'm preaching through the book of Job, which I love, because I'm a Leonard Cohen fan and I'm Scottish and I live in a miserable, dark climate, and I love sitting around with a bottle of malt whiskey, a knife, and I just like being miserable. So I like the book of Job, and it's death, death, and mega death, right? And I just love it. And I was preaching through it, and I'd taken a funeral for this lady, and I looked out, it's a working class Dundee family, and I looked out one Sunday morning and I thought, oh no, there was three pews full of this family, which more than doubled my congregation at that time. And I was preaching on one of the darkest chapters in Job, and it was like 40 minutes about why suffering, why death, why this. And I went to the door, and man shakes my hand at the door, the son, he's about 40 years old, and he said, you did that deliberately, didn't you? I'm not speaking his accent because you wouldn't understand it. Very strong Dundonian. So I'm translating. You did that deliberately, didn't you? What do you... You gave us a whole year's worth of sermons in one go just because we don't come to church. He said, I've never heard anyone speak for more than 5 minutes in my life. And I said, no, I'm really sorry. I said, that's what I do every Sunday. It wasn't specially for you. I said, how did you... I asked him the dread question. How did you cope with it? Now, this is a guy never been in church. Loved it, he said. Absolutely brilliant. I did not know there was that much in the Bible. And I said, that's only one chapter. I've got hundreds more. Will you be back? No. the kind of Christian version of that would be he was converting. No, he disappeared. I've stayed in touch with him. I ended up marrying his daughter. His family got to know them a bit. But that, to me, what he said to me was, the most amazing thing is how relevant that was to our lives today. And I find that across the board. It doesn't matter the culture, doesn't matter the background. Let me offer the Christians here a word of advice. You don't need to make the Bible relevant. It is relevant. Actually, what usually happens is churches make it irrelevant by trying to make it relevant. You know, we are very good at that. But the Bible is relevant. I've never met any culture where the Bible is not relevant. Is not the purest English spoken in the world spoken in Inverness? No, it's spoken in Wagga Wagga. Right. If I haven't read... I just like saying Wagga Wagga, because I thought it was a fantasy town, but I'd met people from there, so they tell me it's real. If I haven't read the Bible as an adult, how do I start? Please get a modern English version. Personally, I'd recommend the New International. One that's kind of readable. And my suggestion would be, do it book at a time. And skip around. I already kind of mentioned that. I probably would start with the Gospel of Luke. That's because I'm a historian, and it begins with Luke explaining how he got his sources and what he's trying to teach. And then I'd maybe go to Genesis, and then I'd maybe do the Psalms, and then I'd maybe do the letter to the Colossians or something. But if you've got any more questions on that, please feel free to email me. Yesterday, our regular meeting with Peter, he was really nasty. Oh, no. The question, how do we know God exists, came up. Faith became one of the topics. We propose to work this by looking backward. Do we accept that Jesus loves us, and do we accept, and so on? I want to address the kind of whole question of faith. By definition, every single person in this room operates on a basis of faith and reason. There is nothing that you do that is absolutely 100% provable. Now, let me just give an example. I said to my wife last night, I'm going down to speak to the lawyers in Silk's restaurant tomorrow morning. Supposing she said to me, will you be okay? I've heard Sydney lawyers can be really dangerous. Maybe they intend to offer you up as a sacrifice. I'm really worried. Please don't go. I don't think I could 100% prove that you weren't about to sacrifice me as some kind of wicker man on the beach or something. It's highly unlikely, given what I know about you and given Peter's invitation. So my faith, if you like, in coming here was based upon a lot of different reasons. Same with flying. I hate flying. Everything in my body tells me we should not be able to get off the ground in that cigar-shaped tin. But my reason tells me we do that. I would like to suggest this, that when it comes to faith in Jesus and faith in God, it's a big mistake to demand 100% proof, because you have nothing in your life that's 100% proof. But what you look for is it reasonable to believe this? Is it reasonable enough for me to commit to this? So I was up in a the big towers up in Toronto, and there's a glass bit between the two towers that it's like Indiana Jones, if you've seen the film, and you know, people step out and walk on it. It's absolutely clear. So it's really freakish when you're so high up. My faith, if you like, says, okay, they tell me there's a tower, there's a walkway, they tell me it's safe, I'm going to step out. It's a step of faith, but it's a step of faith based on reason. And I would argue that's the same. So I don't say to people, just have faith. I would say, have faith because of Jesus. So you investigate who Jesus is, and that's why I'm going to look at that next week. But that's why this week I wanted to look at the Bible, because it's my primary source. And you've got to question whether primary sources are reliable or not, or whether witnesses are reliable. And I would argue the more you look at this, the more you will find that it is.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.